Hey, welcome to Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast. I'm Jason.
I'm Kevin.
I'm John.
And I'm Scott.
And we have a great show for you today. Let us know what's on the OR schedule for the day.
Today on the show, we'll start off as always with our opening shot. And today we'll be discussing ulcerative colitis, a great overview of the disease and the treatment options. And our guest today is the well-known Dr. Steven Wexner from the Cleveland Clinic. And he'll be discussing fecal incontinence with us, as well as giving us some tips and tricks of getting the left colon to reach.
Okay, in today's opening shot, we're going to be talking about ulcerative colitis. Ulcerative colitis falls into the broader category of the inflammatory bowel disease. Of course, you have Crohn's and ulcerative colitis. Today, we're going to focus on UC as it's the one that you can actually cure with surgery. So, Kevin, why don't you tell us just a few of the high points just to get us started on ulcerative colitis?
Yeah, so it's a idiopathic. I mean, we don't know what causes it. Inflammatory bowel disease of the colorectal mucosa. It's equally predominant in males and females. Generally presents in the second to fourth decades of life. There's actually a second peak seen in the 40s to 60s. And then actually 10 to 35%, so almost a third of these patients will require surgical intervention at some point during their disease process. There's some loose genetic factors. They see familial clusters. But one of the more interesting things about it is that actually cigarette smokers, current smokers, are at lower risk of getting ulcerative colitis. So if one thing for you cigarette smokers to hold on to out there. And also patients that get an appendectomy have a protective effect from getting ulcerative colitis. And the theories they vary a lot, but one of the main ones out there is that it's a likely interaction of the gut microorganisms, the host epithelium, and the host immune system, which creates an environment for dysregulated immunity. So it's kind of like your immune system attacking your colonic mucosa is kind of the leading theory out there.
Yeah, you know, a lot of things have been implicated out there. We haven't really found any definitive causes. It is interesting that we know more about what's protective of it than really what causes it. And it is the very last thing for all those cigarette smokers out there to hold on to, aside from the fact that it looks really cool. John, can you tell us a little bit about the pathology and what you might see on a biopsy in a patient with ulcerative colitis?
Sure, Jason. In patients with ulcerative colitis, you would find that the inflammation is mostly limited to the mucosa and the submucosum. The rectum is nearly always involved, and it presents in a continuous fashion. It extends proximally. Patients with UC will also have pseudopolyps, which are ulcers with heaped up, regenerating mucosa. And microscopically, on biopsy, we find that patients with UC will have neutrophils infiltrating into the crypts of Leverkuhn at the base of the mucosa to form crypt abscesses.
Kevin, how might these patients present to your office?
Yeah, the clinical presentation is not much different than Crohn's disease. You can't really differentiate based on the presentation, but a lot of these patients will present with bloody diarrhea, proctitis, anemia, fatigue, anorexia, weight loss. So a lot of very vague complaints. And then on radiographs, they actually have some loss of mucosal folds and Hallstra. I think that's more of a late finding. You have a lead pipe colon. Most of these patients are probably identified before you get to that. And then actually about a third of the patients, or a quarter to a third of the patients, will have extra intestinal manifestations. And pertinent for the abscite, like we always like to highlight, are which of these extra intestinal manifestations respond favorably to colectomy. So the arthritis, the monoarticular arthritis, the uveitis, and iritis all respond favorably to colectomy, which means once they get their colectomy, these symptoms go away. But unfortunately, there are a few extra intestinal manifestations that do not respond to colectomy, and this is the PSC and the ankylosing spondylitis. These will not resolve once you get your colectomy. And then one of the other ones is pyoderma gangrenosum, which varies. Sometimes it does respond, and other times it does not.
Yeah, that's one of those common, you'll see it every year on any standardized test that you take with surgery. You'll have a list of which of this is not going to get better after a colectomy in a patient with UC. And generally the answer is the primary sclerosing cholangitis. That's typically the thing they're going for. But you also have the ankylosing spondylitis and sacroiliitis that often does not respond after a colectomy. So, John, so you have a patient that you suspect of having ulcerative colitis. What are some of the things you can do, and how is a diagnosis really made?
in patients with UC, typically they usually come to you first off because of their symptoms. So you take all those into account. Usually you proceed then with an endoscopy with eventual biopsy. You can check serum antibodies, to include ANCA and ASCA, and also do a Prometheus IBD first step panel.
Yeah, this is one of those things where it's kind of the, you know, you have to take in the whole picture. There's no slam dunk 100% sensitive and specific test that's going to tell you a person has UC. Most hospitals have, or, you know, that's a brand name, the Prometheus IBD first step panel, and it involves a series of different antibodies, the ANCAs, the ASCAs, and what it can really tell you is, you know, a patient has a certain likelihood of having Crohn's over UC, or a certain likelihood of having UC over Crohn's. But at the end of the day, it's a diagnosis that is, you really have to take the whole picture into account, and you can be wrong, and that can have implications depending on if you're deciding to operate on these patients. So Kevin, often before they get to us, they spend a lot of time in the gastrointestinal or the gastroenterologist office. How are these patients managed medically oftentimes before they even make it to see a surgeon?
Well, there's actually two thoughts. There's the step-up approach, where you start with the most least invasive medications, and then there's the step-down approach, where you give them the big guns first and take it down. But generally, I think the step-up approach is the most common, and you'll see them, almost all patients at some point or another, were started on aminosalicylic acids. Also, the main one I've at least seen is mesalamine. And this, you know, varies from patient to patient, but can cause remission and help maintain their remission. So, and that's another important point to make, is there are drugs that you use for maintenance and there are drugs that you use to induce remission. So one of the main ones, you know, a patient has a UC flare, you'll give them steroids. And generally, steroids are not meant to be long-term treatments. It's just to induce remission, and then you put them on a maintenance therapy. So you have the aminosalicylic acids that are for remission and maintenance. You have the steroids, which induce remission. And then you have the immunomodulators, which are both also induce remission and for maintenance. And these are the different drugs you see mostly in the transplant wards, the azathioprines, the 6-MPs, the cyclosporin, the tacrolimus. And then lastly, and at least the ones that I've seen, seems that the gastroenterologists are going to more and more, is the biologic agents, where they actually have antibodies towards the TNF-alphas. And the main one you see with that is infliximab. And I think it's normally called Remicade. And this is also to induce remission and for maintenance.
So, John, what are some of the indications that would kind of lead you towards counseling a patient that they may want to have their colon out?
Yeah, Jason, you know, one of the interesting things about UC is that in comparison to Crohn's disease, we can essentially alleviate all the symptoms from an operation. And other patients that will eventually need an operation with UC include patients with toxic colitis, perforation, hemorrhage, malignancy, disabling extracolonic disease, and then growth retardation. In addition, UC poses a colon cancer risk. The risk of having developing colon cancer is relatively low when a patient has UC for less than 10 years. However, this cumulative risk increases over time, and at 20 years, a patient with UC will have a 10% risk of developing colon cancer, and at 30 years, up to 18%. And then also, a patient with any type of dysplasia found on biopsies is also an indication for colectomy.
Yeah, a good way of kind of breaking it up is you have your elective indications and your emergent indications. Obviously, anybody who shows up with a toxic megacolon and a perforation or uncontrollable bleeding needs an operation. And then you have, you know, the people that aren't responding to medical management, or maybe the child that has growth retardation. And you have a cancer risk, like you said. You know, you had 10 years, the cancer risk is pretty low. But from that point on, it goes up about 1% to 2% every year. So those are the patients that you need to have on an aggressive screening regimen. And at any sign of dysplasia, you need to start talking to them about a surgery. So with regard to surgery, Kevin, what are your options?
So there's a wide variety of options. If you want to go with the safest option and consider the quote-unquote gold standard, you can do the total proctocolectomy with an endoleostomy. This, you have no increased risk of cancer, and you have no need to take steroids at this point. And there's also some centers that will try to use continent ileostomies. But the next kind of step to maintain some sort of continence is the abdominal colectomy with the ileorectal anastomosis. The problem with this, obviously, is some of the rectum is kept, so you do not achieve total excision of the colorectal mucosa. And then up to 25% of these patients will require a rectal excision due to persistent bursitis, proctitis, and there's also a small malignancy risk. And so the go-to option now, especially for young patients that have good anal sphincter tone and are healthy, and is the ileopouch anal anastomosis, where you do the total proctocolectomy and make a J-pouch out of their ileum to mimic a rectum. And this is complete excision of the colorectal mucosa. And but, you know, these have their problems too.
Yeah, and just to mention briefly is, you know, a lot of people out there who aren't necessarily colorectal surgeons may see these patients in the emergent setting if they show up with a perforation or bleeding. And John, are those a patient that you would want to do a proctocolectomy and do an endileostomy, and or is that a patient that maybe you're okay leaving the rectum there for now and dealing with it at a later date?
Well, I think the latter is the answer there, Jason. In these patients, you want to perform the colectomy, and then generally you want to address the rectum in a subsequent operation. However, if you're looking at bleeding, you want to make sure the rectum is not bleeding before leaving it in.
Yeah, and that's exactly right. You don't want to burn any bridges. If you do a total proctocolectomy, you're pretty much dooming that patient to having an ileostomy for the rest of their life, and they don't have a chance at any form of reconstruction once they can get to a colorectal surgeon and get, you know, an IPA or something like that. So a great point. Something that often comes up is you're dealing with the length of the bowel, and if you're doing a total colectomy and ileopouch anal anastomosis, you know, it's a difficult operation, it's a difficult anastomosis, and you're having difficulty getting the length on that small bowel to reach down to the anus. Kevin, what are some maneuvers that you can do in a stepwise fashion that can help you get a little extra length of the bowel?
Yeah, this is a difficult problem. The first and easiest and likely has already been tried is you really want to mobilize the small bowel mesentery without compromising any of the vascular flow. So the most mobilization you can get on that, the better, the more reach you're going to have. The second step you want to go to is you want to score the mesentery. And this can also give you at least a few centimeters of room, depending on how much mesentery you score. It allows it to open up and give you a little more reach. And then you can get to the point where you're actually ligating vessels. Hopefully there's good enough collaterals. And the way you do that is you actually clamp and you use your Doppler tones and see if clamping that vessel, if the bowel will still have perfusion. And if it does, you can take those vessels, and ligating the vessels will actually give you probably the most bang for your buck. And then, you know, lastly, they have different sort of pouch configurations you can do where you actually add an extra loop on to the bowel into your, you know, J pouch, making it an S or W pouch, which will hopefully help it reach a little deeper into that pelvis.
Yeah, we'll let you just read about the S and W pouch. They're kind of complicated. It's impossible to really describe over a podcast. As we know, in surgery, nothing comes for free, and these can be morbid operations. You know, best case scenario, with an IPAA, you're telling a patient they're going to have 6 to 8 loose bowel movements a day, and that's good. So, John, what are some other, you know, complications that can result from some of these surgeries?
Yeah, Jason, you know, the complications that come from any type of operation with UC are similar to those ones you'd also find in a patient that we enter the abdomen. The first, the most common one is small bowel obstruction, occurs about 20% of the patients. Anastomotic leak occurs about 10% of the patients. Obviously, this depends on a different type of procedure. Pelvic sepsis from intra-abdominal contamination is possible, 5% of patients. There's also anastomotic stricture, the pouch and failure in the patients we're creating that J-pouch, sexual dysfunction, pouch vaginal fistula, and then pouchitis also is another one.
Yeah, just things to keep in mind when you're counseling patients for surgery. You know, those numbers are obviously going to be a little different depending on how you read, but it's important to let patients know that some of these things can occur. Okay, well, that does it for our discussion of ulcerative colitis, and just a brief overview for our opening shot.
Today's random fact of the day has to deal with cocaine. And the profession we most commonly associate with cocaine nowadays is Wall Street and the financial industry. But actually, back when it was first discovered, it was widely used among the medical profession.
I think some of the most common uses we all know is used as an anesthetic. But in eye surgery specifically, doctors used to use the cocaine solution on a patient's cornea to render the eye temporarily immobile and sensitive to pain. And doctors quickly realized that cocaine was not just good for the eyes, but also had more useful numbing effects in the nose and throat as well. And they used to use it during procedures.
Yeah, but although cocaine may have been used as a medicine, it wasn't regulated like one, and it became wildly popular. By the turn of the 20th century, cocaine was being mixed into everything from soft drinks to wines to medicinal tonics. They even had large mail-order companies that would ship cocaine directly to your house. By the turn of the century, you could walk into any pharmacy and buy a packet of cocaine for about 25 cents. And it was used for just about anything. It was prescribed for things from hemorrhoids to indigestion to an appetite suppressant and even for fatigue. Some of the most famous people out there that became proponents of the use of cocaine were Thomas Edison, Jules Verne, and the McKinley White House. And it wasn't just for adults. Cocaine was also recommended for children for toothaches and became packaged with dosing instructions for children.
And as you can imagine, with the cheap prices of cocaine, Americans became addicted at an alarming rate. By 1902, they say 200,000 Americans were cocaine addicts. And a disproportionate amount of these were actually doctors, dentists, and pharmacists. And most famously, in the surgery world, we know of William Halstead, who was using it in research purposes and became addicted to it later in his career. And it was around the 1910s that they realized the devastating effect of this drug and started regulating it more tightly. And that has been your random fact of the day.
All right, now we're prepped and draped. Let's get into the dissection of the day.
So welcome, everybody, to another edition of Behind the Knife. We are absolutely thrilled today to have a very special guest. This is Dr. Stephen Wexner, who is the Cleveland Clinic Florida Director of Digestive Disease Center and Chairman of the Department of Colorectal Surgery. He's been there since 1993. An extremely productive surgeon and academician and leader. He's been the past president of the Society of the American Gastrointestinal and Endoscopic Surgeons. He's also been the past president of ASCARS. He's been the past president of the American Board of Colorectal Surgeons, and he runs a wonderful program and is a symposium director of the annual International Colorectal Disease Symposium every spring down in Florida, something I would encourage everybody to visit at least once. And Dr. Wexner, thank you so much for joining us at Behind the Knife.
Oh, you're quite welcome, and thank you very much for the privilege of having me as a guest on this wonderful show.
So for those who don't know as much, maybe living in a cave for a while, about your background, can you talk a little bit about where you're from, where you trained and everything, and how it came to the point where your path brought you to Cleveland Clinic, Florida, and how you really built that institution in colorectal in specific into what it is today?
Well, thank you for those flattering introductory remarks. I'm a native of New York and did my education there. Undergraduate at Columbia, then my med school graduation was from Cornell, and I worked at Roosevelt Hospital, which was one of the Columbia hospitals at the time. And I had some great mentors there in colorectal surgery, Tom Daly, who was one of the pioneers of the ASCRS Research Foundation, and a fellow named Rick Brabe, who was his partner. And they got me quite interested, along with a number of other surgeons, in colorectal surgery. And one of them, Rick Babe, had trained in Minnesota and started bringing me out to Stan Goldberg's course, mostly for the purpose, as I was pleased to do at the time, and I've subsequently done myself, to help him get his talks together and do the background material and put his talks that, okay, as a reward, you can come to the course. And I liked the people I met. Went there for fellowship in colorectal, and about 3 months into that, year as a colorectal trainee with Stan Goldberg, had the good fortune to meet David Jagelman, who was one of the speakers that year at the Minnesota course. And we sat together at dinner, and he asked me what I was doing at the end of the year. And I said, well, I've got a variety of opportunities. I've looked at a few, and I asked if I wanted to work at Cleveland Clinic. And I said, well, it's an idea. I said, I have a Cleveland Clinic in Florida. He said, I'm moving to Florida. We're starting a new venture during 1988, that was, in February 88. They're going to be opening in Florida. So I went and looked at, there wasn't anything to look at in Florida because nothing was opened yet, and went to Ohio, interviewed with Fazio and Lavery and Jagel and a variety of others, and signed up and started working there, really getting stuff ready while I was still a trainee, because there was about a four-month period when David was working and I was going down on weekends and helping set things up, and then started July 1. I thought it was a great opportunity to be in a name brand institution, but in a very, for me anyway, geographically desirable location.
Thank you, Dr. Wexner, for that great background. This is John McClellan speaking. One of the things that you've been extremely successful with is collaboration and team building. Can you talk a little bit more about the importance of collaboration, not only here, but internationally as well?
Yeah, I mean, I've always had a penchant for travel, so I guess that kind of fits in well with it. And I also, you know, again, as testimony to Stan Goldberg, who was really, and I gather before him, it was Harry Baker, that there were people who really enjoyed embracing other cultures and other surgeons. And what I found was that at the meetings at ASCRS and others, the speakers were routinely American, North American, Canadian, maybe UK, perhaps Australia, but we weren't really hearing from the huge numbers of surgeons with vast experiences in China and Japan and Russia and India and Latin America, with very, very few exceptions. I said, you know, and as I traveled, I realized these people, like us, have a lot to say. In many cases, they have a very different experience, perhaps even a larger experience, and we don't read what they write. So really, from day one, I decided I'm going to form my annual course around international folks, not around necessarily Americans, and that was one. And the other is, as I wrote books and collaborated on research studies where possible, I said I'm going to engage people from overseas because they have a lot to contribute. And people are very appreciative of that. And so it sort of is the snowball effect, where the more you engage them, the more they ask you to come and help them with their meetings and with their projects and such, and send people to train, which is another thing that I've had a very large contingent of overseas researchers, again, since day one, because people knew that they would get a fair shake and I would let them actually do research and encourage them to work. And not that that was novel, but perhaps the level to which I did it may have been, at that time, in the late 1980s, somewhat unprecedented.
Along those lines, you've been amazingly productive. Altogether, you have over 550 manuscripts, 220 textbook chapters, and 26 editor, co-editor of textbooks, freestanding volumes. How have you been able to accomplish all this while being clinically active, and what advice do you give to surgeons who desire to pursue academic surgery, and writing in particular?
Well, one of the things that I did when I was undergraduate at Columbia was decide to be an English major, very specifically because I knew I wanted to be a surgeon from when I was a little kid. I mean, as long back as I can remember, I wanted to be a surgeon, and my mom confirms that was like a lifelong idea. But I also thought that it would be very useful to really know how to, because I was interested in the academic aspects, how to write. So I was an English major. That, I think, helps a little bit to begin with, because I can do things perhaps in a different way than somebody without that background, number one. Number two, the idea is that you've got to figure out how to juggle things around, and you know, these days it's called life balance or life-work balance, but you've got to know how to juggle things around while you're working, and you know, what schedule works for one person won't necessarily work for another. But for me, I think the important thing is that I really enjoy it. I like trying to find new thoughts and trying to prove or disprove concepts with research studies, and I like subsequently codifying that in some sort of enduring material. And the writing aspect, again, I've always enjoyed that, whether it's fiction, nonfiction. So I don't find it a chore, put it that way. And I think the key to success for anyone in any industry, most likely, although this is the only one in which I've spent my life, is to have a passion for something. And if you really enjoy what you do, chances are you'll probably be better at it. Now, you also need some sort of an aptitude as well, because you could, I mean, I could want to be a professional basketball player, and you know, people would laugh at me because I don't have the talent, the aptitude. So you do need both. But you can have a ton of aptitude and not like it, and then I don't think you'll get as much done. So it's that balance. It's just the way you look at it. I mean, I can't give a specific formula for, you know, from 5 a.m. to 6 a.m. you do this, and 6 a.m. to 9 a.m. you do that. It's an individual schedule has to be worked out, number one. Number two, you hit on it before, and that is collaboration. It is engaging other people with whom you're going to work, so you divide up the workload. It's impossible for anybody, well, I shouldn't say anybody, it'd be impossible for me to do everything by myself. And having willing co-workers, colleagues, collaborators is the key to success, and recognizing those people. You know, you have to find what people enjoy, what makes them tick. That gets them more engaged as well, and you get a better work product.
So you can say that all you want, but still, along the lines, it's unbelievable some of the things that you've done. So for those out there who want to pursue a career in academic surgery and writing, and were you that aren't English majors, what advice do you give to them in terms of medical writing, which may be completely different from somebody who is a pretty good writer in English in college?
Well, I think the idea is to work with somebody who's going to pay attention to what you're doing. I mean, number one is don't say no to any assignment. Somebody asks you to help them with something, you do it. You do it well. You do it on time, as you do, Dr. Steele. And we all know that. It's a pleasure working with you because everything gets done quickly, gets done professionally, gets done well. So you, number one, when you're starting out in your career, and later for that matter, you know, unless there's some particular mitigating circumstance, don't decline things. This is key. Once you accept something, make sure you prioritize it to get it done on time and get it done well. People take notice of that, and then you're on the sort of short list for more assignments. In terms of how to write, that's a hard one to really explain. If you don't have a background in it, work with somebody who does. If you're in an institution where there are medical editors, you know, pay attention to the way they're correcting your manuscript. If you're a senior author, and I went through this with a guy, again, Tom Daly, back at Roosevelt, when I was writing manuscripts as a general surgery resident, he tore them apart with a red pen, and I thought, God, I thought I knew what I was doing. As you say, maybe it's a different style of writing, but pay attention to it. Don't be offended by it. Learn from it. And say, aha, you know, I've got this, and I still have certain things that I now will use as teaching points on my residents and fellows' manuscripts that I learned from him in 30 years ago that carry through. So it's important when you have constructive criticism, take it as such, as constructive criticism.
One of my first papers I wrote with Dr. Steele, I've actually kept the markup because it is so humorous as to how much was changed in a single edit. But I kind of keep it on my wall to show people as a little bit of pride.
That's because it sucked. Anyway, so let's switch gears here very quickly here. So one of the things that we're seeing a lot across the board is this trend towards evidence-based medicine, not only that, but also in terms of transparency and outcomes and who should be doing what, and along those lines, you've been one of the leaders on the national scenes in terms of dealing with the American College of Surgeons and the Commission on Cancer in terms of developing this rectal cancer center of excellence. Can you talk a little bit about that and talk about maybe where we are right now with that, where it's heading, and how is this going to play into not only rectal cancer but potentially other fields across medicine?
Well, it's a very good point, and the background of it is that throughout Europe, for the last 20 years or so, there have been a variety of initiatives looked at, started with Bill Heald, and that was another stroke of luck, by the way, I must say, being in the right place at the right time, that when I was a general surgery resident, I can't say, it's probably PGY2, when I went out to Stan's course, Bill Heald was one of the speakers, and I'm somewhat of an Anglophile, to say the least, and he and I got to chatting, and he said, well, come visit Basingstoke, which I did. And I was his house guest as a mid-level general surgery resident when he was just getting started with this stuff, and I still have the book, much as, you know, you've Scott Steele's paper. I have a little atlas Bill gave me that he did with Lockhart Mummery on mesorectal excision, still with what he wrote in it, you know, thanks for helping on Mr. So-and-so, awful deep pelvis. Of course, it's like anything else when you're on impress somebody, have a BMI of 45 patient or something with a large tumor. But I, you know, operated with him as a general surgery resident. He tried to recruit me over there as a senior registrar, and I said, no, I'm going to do my colorectal, again, probably at Stan's advice, do my colorectal training first, we'll see what happens later. But he's remained a very, very close, lifelong friend, and I think that's very good fortune that's happened. And my subsequently, many years later, my kids ended up being his house guest many times. But be that as it may, that it's a combination of who you know, who you work with, and having good mentors, right? That's always the key. So because the work Bill did with TME and following along as closely as I did, seeing what happened in Sweden and Denmark, as well as in the UK, in the Netherlands, with what they call centers of excellence, what we're going to call accredited centers, in these centers, that outcomes significantly improved throughout Scandinavia, parts of Western Europe, and the UK, specifically lower mortality, lower rates of permanent stoma creation, lower rates of local recurrence. So really meaningful outcomes improved. And what triggered the improvement wasn't just operating with Bill. That's a part of it. It's doing a proper TME, but it's also being able to know who needs neoadjuvant and who doesn't based upon preoperative staging, as Gina Brown has taught us with pelvic MRI. It's based upon getting good pathologic specimen assessment back, so you know whether or not you did a complete TME or a near complete or an incomplete TME, and knowing what your circumferential resection margins are. So Phil Quirk did a lot of work in that regard, and in this country, Mariana Burroughs picked up that gauntlet. So what was pivotal to the success of these programs, which translated to success for the patients with rectal cancer in Europe, was all of those elements coming together as a team, plus medical and radiation oncology in the MDT, the Multidisciplinary Tumor Conference. The difference from a tumor board here, where we may discuss the interesting or the unusual cases or the challenging cases, in those countries, it became required to discuss every case. So in every single instance, every case is discussed prior to surgery, then after surgery, and then after definitive therapy, so perhaps three times with all of those different people in the room, the specialist pathologist, the specialist imager, the colorectal surgeon, or surgical oncologist, or general surgeon, whoever's doing all the surgery, and then medical radiation oncology as a baseline, plus perhaps others. So we took we being Feza Remzi, and I have to thank Feza, because when I was president-elect of ASCRS, he said to me, this is the time to bring rectal cancer forward in this country. You know, we really need to do this. You're in a position, we can get this done, said Feza. To change stuff in the U.S., I mean, it's not like it's a 6 million person country. This is, but nonetheless, I took Feza's advice, and I have to thank him for that. And he said, don't worry, Dave Dietz will help you. Okay, Dave Dietz, John Monson, Feza, Mariana, and we relied on a couple of others, like Jim Fleshman, to get everything that had been done in Europe compiled and to suggest to the Commission on Cancer, and I happen to be a member of the Commission on Cancer, so and a member of the Accreditation Committee, in fact, so I, again, right place, right time, work with that group and presented to the individuals there, Dave Winchester and Danny Takanishi and Linda Ferris, Accreditation and the Chair of Commission, here's this idea we have to create an accreditation track for rectal cancer, employing the elements that have been employed in Europe, successfully employed, and have been proven to improve patient outcomes. They liked the concept and, in fact, thought perhaps this could even be a template, and you alluded to it earlier, for other types of cancer, pancreas, esophagus, whatever, down the road, for this accreditation program. And we then presented it to the border regions, and again, I'm very honored and privileged to be on the border regions, so I got to present it to the border regions, who also liked it. So this evolved over the last 4 years from being what's called the Ostrich Consortium, starting with Feza Remzi prodding me and getting a few others involved, and the Ostrich Consortium, which is optimizing surgery for rectal cancer group, basically, started with basically a few people and now has over 200 centers through the country involved in the Ostrich Consortium. And you can look at the website. It's www.ostrichconsortium.org. It will show what's going on with it. It evolved over 4 years, and the current status is a work group that's comprised of individuals from the American College of Surgeons. It's a fairly high-level group, to say the least. David Hoyt and David Winchester, the medical director of the cancer programs at the college, and myself and a variety of others, Dan McKellar, the chair of the Commission on Cancer, again, same people helping with it, John Monson and Dave Dietz and Mariana Barrow, and folks from the American College of Radiology, Mary Kay Washington from College of American Pathology has been helpful. That collaboration is the key to success because the program is not a program of colorectal surgeons. It is a program of surgeons who operate on rectal cancer, and their backgrounds may be general surgery, surgical oncology, laparoscopic, minimally invasive surgery, or colorectal surgery, working with the College of American Pathology, American College of Radiology on the perioperative variables. The work group has established all of the standards. The standards manual is written. We're adding one more standard. It's being distributed to a variety of other societies, SSAT, SAGES, ASCRS, to review and comment. And the idea is that in late 2015, the pilot site surveys will occur. And hopefully in 2016, a lot of accreditation surveys will occur. The idea is that any center with Commission on Cancer accreditation who can meet the standards for rectal cancer accreditation can also apply for that accreditation.
So where is that going to ultimately leave us, though? So let's say that I'm in an institution that either doesn't buy into this program, that are not accredited, or you're the single surgeon out there that you are credentialed to perform rectal cancer surgery, but are you going to be able to do it? Are you going to be left out in the cold? And is this going to be something that becomes punitive?
Well, what we're trying to do is not be punitive to the patient. And just like there are all of these public databases now that have rather bizarre in some circumstances metrics that are publicly reported, we would like the patients to at least be aware that there are differences in outcomes. That's been proven in multiple countries over two decades, and that we think we can reproduce the same thing here and not be punitive to the patient. If somebody wants to participate, then they need to meet whatever those standards are. If somebody chooses not to participate, that's fine too. They can do whatever it is they want to do. People will just understand there's a difference whether you're COC accredited with rectal cancer accreditation or not. In no way would people be prevented from doing any operation for which they're trained and licensed and credentialed. But the hope is that that surgeon, rather than being left in the cold, would go to his or her hospital administrator and say, listen, I do, you know, 50 TMEs a year. You need to make sure that we have a good MRI imager here, that we have a pathologist, that the imager has taken the American College of Radiology module, which is under development, that the pathologist has worked with College of American Pathology to ensure appropriate synoptic reporting and has done their skills course online, which is being developed, and so on, and support that so that my patients can get the same care as they can down the street, across town, whatever it happens to be. And if not, then figure out how to collaborate with people from another institution. And there have been some examples of that where there are inter-institutional MDTs that meet, and that may be what has to be applicable in more rural areas, for example. And there's a couple of articles floating around under peer review showing how that is feasible. So the idea, I like the word punitive, is to make sure we're not being punitive to the patient by pretending that the outcomes are the same regardless of where and by whom the surgery is done and whether or not a team exists.
So is there any talk as a follow-up to this regarding cost or anything? I know that the Bariatric Center of Excellence, when this came out, one of the feedbacks that came out and some of the drawbacks to it that was passed around was the tremendous amount of cost. And not only the cost we're talking about assembling the team in place, but the annual cost to have that designation as a center of excellence. And what did that really buy the institution other than the fact that you could say you were a center of excellence?
Well, what we know from the few centers who've gone this route, and again, unfortunately, I can't share the data because some of these are peer review manuscripts I've looked at lately from different places around the U.S., where in anticipation of this program coming, people have adopted the MDT approach and adopted the issue of discussing every case, and there have been changes in management reported in roughly a third of cases in most of these papers, and some people have begun also to show improvement in quality, the number of complete TMEs. When you're sitting there showing all your specimens, it's like anything else. Once you're examining it, the quality gets better. So I can't speak towards bariatric surgery, but I can definitely speak to what I've already begun to see in this country, just merely by people knowing that this is in the pipeline, that there's already been an improvement in outcomes. And some of these are places, like you say, where there wasn't much going on before, and people suddenly galvanized and said, hey, we too can do this, let's do it. And they're not all big university hospitals, I can tell you. So I think that in terms of cost, I don't know what the accreditation fee is going to be, but this is an add-on to the Commission on Cancer Accreditation. And the COC is something from memory about 1,700 accredited hospitals, something like that, which care for, from memory, something between 70 and 80% of newly diagnosed cancers every year. So it's an add-on accreditation, and the idea will be to keep it very as low cost as possible. Specifically, the same survey for COC that already would be done will be done. The only difference is because you tick the box saying rectal cancer, that there'd be a few additional variables looked at, probably attendance at the rectal cancer MDT. The first round, that's not necessarily feasible. The first round probably is a separate visit because not everybody is up for reaccreditation at the same time. But as the program cycles, it would be part of the COC accreditation visit anyway. So I can't imagine a big cost, though I don't have a number to tell you. But if you're doing a lot of rectal cancer, you're going to have these elements in place anyway.
Okay, now it's time for our dissection of the day. This is a segment where we go in depth into a particular topic. And today with Dr. Wexner, we'd like to tap into your vast experience and briefly discuss the recent advancements in the treatment and management of fecal incontinence. For those of us not as familiar, what is your evaluation of a patient who presents with fecal incontinence? And along those lines, what initial testing needs to be done with patients, such as anorectal physiology testing?
Well, this might be somewhat heretical, but I think we've come rather full circle. And when I was a general surgery resident, there was no physiology testing. And then even in residency, we didn't have EMG. We didn't have anal ultrasound. We had manometry, and we had defogram and balloon proctography. And then I went over to St. Mark's and spent some time and convinced my neurologist to do pudendal nerve studies, like Henry and Swash were doing at the time, and EMGs. We added that to the armamentarium. And then anal ultrasound came along. And then every patient had to get every study. And I really think it's cycled the other direction. All those studies are there, but for the most part, you don't need to do them. And that may be heresy. What you need to do is talk to the patient, find out what might be the cause of that incontinence, take a good history. You need to examine the patient and see, is there an obvious reason for the incontinence, such as a sphincter defect or not, or some other anatomic abnormality. And selectively, you'd apply the tests. If somebody is, for example, incontinent, they had three prior vaginal deliveries, they had a repair, there seems to be some bulk, but it doesn't contract, that patient might warrant either an anal ultrasound or an MRI to see if there's scar or there's muscle anteriorly. I personally think the pudendal studies is more of, or several of our prior publications have shown, I think pudendal nerve studies are reasonable if you're going to do a sphincter repair to try to counsel someone as to the rate of success, but it's not mandatory. I don't think manometry adds much in incontinence. I think you can tell that from your office exam. It's reasonable to have if you're doing research. It's reasonable to have as a baseline so you can monitor change, but it's by no means mandatory. Defecography or MRR proctography could be useful to help exclude an intussusception, and those patients sometimes do not do as well with certain things, but none of it's mandatory. What's mandatory is talking to the patient, getting an incontinence score, examining the patient. I mean, that's what's mandatory.
So, sir, there are many grading schemes out there for every disease process, and grading schemes for fecal incontinence is the fecal incontinence quality of life score. But it seems that most authors and surgeons nowadays refer to the Cleveland Clinic fecal incontinence score, or better known as the Wexner score. Can you give us a little backstory behind that and how you came up with that scoring system?
Well, yeah, I mean, basically prior to that time, people were using grading systems for the most part, like Park's grading system of ABC, which does not give you the same level of detail as a score. And although there were a few scores, Dave Rothenberger had a score, they didn't include any quality of life parameter. So I thought that we had Parks, Pescatori was another one. There were a whole lot of grading systems, not much in the way of scoring systems. And the scoring system out there didn't include, as I say, does this influence your life? Do you have to wear a pad? I mean, simple things, but quality of life metrics. So I said, well, if we add these things, this might make sense, and then we can come up with, the other point was something simple, you know, something easy to do that you can do off the top of your head, quickly on a piece of paper, and you have a number, and you can then monitor patients. So that was the impetus behind it, was to have a tool that was useful, clinically useful, not cumbersome, but gave more detail than any of the grading systems, and addressed to some degree quality of life. Now, it was subsequently modified. Carol Ann Vasey at St. Mark's modified it as the Vasey or St. Mark's score by adding urgency, and I have an issue with urgency because incontinence and leakage is the sphincters, and although it may be influenced by the nature of the stool, solid or liquid, that's addressed in the score itself. Once you put in urgency may have nothing to do with the anal sphincters. Urgency is more likely due to some form of proctitis, radiation proctitis, inflammatory bowel disease, or an anatomic aberration in the rectum, like there's been an anterior resection or colloidal anastomosis, like now Soren Lauerberg's described this LARS score, low anterior section syndrome. Urgency is a different issue. And I think that's probably why more investigators use the Cleveland Clinic than the St. Mark's score, because urgency is a separate variable that's related to the rectum, whereas the other variables in our score relate to the anal sphincter. People have gotten the other extreme. There's an American Medical System score that goes up to 120. I mean, you can't possibly remember what the numbers are and how to get there. And it becomes weighted. And once you start weighting scores, what you find is the weighting, the amount of importance attached to any variable may be different for the investigators than for the patients. So we, being a committee or an ad hoc task force from the ASCRS, and I think it included Ann Lowry and Jim Fleshman and myself and one of my fellows at the time, Konstantinos Mavrontonis, worked with a guy named Todd Rockwood to develop the fecal incontinence quality of life and the fecal incontinence severity index. And it's interesting because we had focus groups of doctors and of patients, and the weighting by doctors and patients was in fact different. So the scores were created based upon what the doctors thought, but that was different than what the patients thought. So weighting becomes problematic, particularly in simple scores. And therefore, again, ours isn't weighted. So when you look at the Cleveland Clinic score, it's just simply 0 to 4 for every variable. It's not weighted, and it doesn't include urgency, and I think that's why it's popular. I mean, fecal incontinence quality of life is a wonderful instrument, as is the fecal incontinence severity index. But again, you need a lot of prompts to remember the questions to ask. It's not simple, something that you instantly memorize and never forget and can use every day in practice, and it's more cumbersome. That's always the balance. The more cumbersome the score, the less likely someone to use it, although the more detail and the more granularity you get. Conversely, a simpler score won't give you necessarily that level of detail, but it's very easy to use. And, you know, that's, you can look at the citation, you know, how many times each score has been cited, and you see what people's preference is. And the interesting thing is a lot of times these scores aren't even referenced by authors in their publications because they assume everyone knows it. It's like anatomy. You know, you don't reference it. You just say Cleveland Clinic score, and there it is. So there's, for every citation, there's probably three more that are not cited if you look through literature. It's been validated in multiple languages throughout the world, so it has stood the test of validation. It's by no means perfect by a long shot, but it's user-friendly and validated and clinically useful.
I hope other scoring systems will take those into account. It seems very helpful. Sir, I got to ask, though, because I know when Dr. Steele gets his own eponym, he's going to do this, but when your residents and fellows present to you a patient with fecal incontinence, do you ask them what's my score?
No, I just say, what's the incontinence score?
Easy there, Kevin. Easy there. So, moving on. So, Dr. Wexler, go ahead.
Do that. We actually have a constipation score also, which is a little more cumbersome, also been validated, perhaps not used as much, and Antonio Longo built his obstructed defecation score off of our platform, and that, I'm not sure which one, I haven't looked, which one is more used, but it's, you know, he notes in his publication it's based on the Cleveland Clinic constipation score.
You know, so, I got to think about this now, Dr. Wexner. In that original Wexner score paper, you weren't the first author in that one, though, were you?
No, my resident was, which, again, that's part of, you've got to support the people doing the work. It's Marcio George. It's spelled J-O-R-G-E, but he's Brazilian, so it's pronounced George, not Jorge, as it would if he were from anywhere else in South America.
Yeah, why is it not the George score? I mean, what's up with that? I would be, if I was him, I'd be like, do you mean the George score, not the Wexner score? Anyway, moving on.
Feel free. I encourage people to call Cleveland Clinic score, the Cleveland Clinic score. In Brazil, they do tend to call it the George and Wexner score, I can tell you that.
I think that's fantastic. You know, when we had Dr. Maddox on, we absolutely had to ask him about how he performs a Maddox maneuver, so we would be amiss not to ask you this. But so moving on with the patient. So now you've evaluated the patient. You've graded how hard their fecal incontinence is. So now it's come time to institute therapy. I think everybody can agree upon medical therapy with bulking agents or anti-motility things. But can you talk a little bit about biofeedback? And that has really two different camps out there. What is biofeedback for those who don't know about it and aren't familiar with it? And can you talk a little bit about how you feel about it and what role does it play in the patient with fecal incontinence?
Well, firstly, in terms of the medical manager, it's very interesting. If you look at the guidelines which you just released, the ASCRS guidelines, or the ACG guidelines, which were perhaps a year earlier, I mean, the levels of evidence for the non-surgical treatment are based more upon volume of people in the literature saying that you should do this rather than randomized controlled trials. So first off, so yes, of course everyone does it, but it's actually interesting when you read the various guidelines and try and look at what the evidence is for. Biofeedback, I think the more proper way to probably think of it is pelvic floor retraining, because you're trying to really teach the patient how to better use their entire pelvic floor. Might be a better way to think of it. And that should be done in conjunction with whatever maneuvers such as bulking agents and anti-motility and anti-diarrheal agents. And then the main thing we found with biofeedback was you've got to have a very good therapist doing it. The therapist has to have a lot of patience, not individuals, but time on their hands and commitment to sit there and listen to people with incontinence or conversely constipation, and the patient has to be committed to the therapy. Somebody goes once or twice isn't going to do well. Somebody says, fine, I'm in for 10 sessions if necessary, we'll probably do better. Practicing at home is probably going to help. You know, it's a zero morbidity therapy, so I don't see any reason to not try it. In patients with moderate incontinence, I don't think, in other words, a score of something, you know, 4 to perhaps 10, it might do well. Somebody with a score of 20 is probably not going to derive much significant benefit out of biofeedback. Somebody with a cloacal injury, somebody with a big anterior sphincter gap, you know, they're probably not going to do well with biofeedback. I don't know that I'd subject them to it. But, you know, somebody comes in and says, I have some leakage on an occasional basis. You know, I end up wearing a pad when I'm playing sports. And fair enough. I think that's reasonable to do the medical trial in biofeedback.
So, sir, continuing on with therapy options, you know, one of the most traditional surgical procedures that was used is the overlapping sphincteroplasty. Recently, there's been some data that demonstrates that after 1 to 2 years, the improvement that the patient's experience will fall off. You know, why did this fall out of favor? And indeed, if that is true, right now, what patients should we be using this in?
You know, this becomes sort of personalized medicine, because the way I approach it, as I say to the patient these days, and trust me, our papers early on in the late 80s, again, Jim Fleshman and I both published on this, and we both reported success rates in the 80s, 80-85% short term. But when you look at the longer-term papers out of Minnesota, out of Cleveland Clinic, Ohio, other places, you find complete continence in pretty much nobody at 5 to 10 years, and maybe the overall success rate might be 15%. So what I tell people is you have a sphincter defect. We could repair it. It probably has about an 80-85% short-term success, meaning at least a 50% decrease in your incontinence score. But you will need something else done at a later date. So this would be the first step, is anatomically repairing the defect. And then at some later date, you would need something done, whether sphincter replacement with autologous muscle, with stimulated autologous muscle out of the U.S., we can't do it in the U.S., with an artificial bowel sphincter, with perhaps at some future date in the U.S., a magnetic anal sphincter, with bulking agents, another sphincter augmentation, with radiofrequency energy or with bulking agents, or, you know, something, say, sacral neuromodulation, whatever. You know, you're going to need something else down the road. Now, the other thing we could do is leave that defect be, try sacral neuromodulation, which we know works in patients with defects. The largest, I think, was the Joe Chandra study with 120-degree defects, and I think the FDA labeling, based upon our trial in the U.S. of 120 patients, I think the labeling is something like 60 degrees. But nonetheless, you could tell the patient, yeah, you have a defect, we're going to try SNM, and if it works, you're set, and if not, we can go back and repair the sphincter later. But it's personalized medicine. Which does the patient prefer? I can't tell them one is better than the other. Just, you know, some people are rather loath to have an implant of a stimulator. Others don't want to have an incision in their perineum, and you know, 6 weeks of healing. So it's individual.
So this may be taking a step back, but what are the etiologies of these sphincter deficits? Is it mainly women that have had multiple pregnancies, or is it prior anal rectal procedures?
Well, number one is obstetric, and number two is other iatrogenic for sphincter defects.
Great.
Then there's a category of trauma, but it's much lower number.
So you talked a little bit about this a minute ago. Could you talk about SNS a little bit more? Obviously, one of the more common emerging therapies that was used for years in Europe and recently FDA approved here in the U.S. is the sacral nerve stimulation, or SNS. It seems to be finding a little bit more roles in a lot of different settings, even patients with obstructive defecation, understanding that I don't think we have an FDA approval for constipation or obstructive defecation yet. But can you talk about how this fits into your algorithm, and how do you see it going forward for these patients?
Yeah, I mean, sacral neuromodulation has been around since the mid-90s when Klaus Matzell and Erlang in Germany described it. It's been around a lot longer and used much more for urology, for overactive bladder, for sure. So we you know, this is a technology that we adapted from the urologists. In the U.S., the only labeling is for fecal incontinence, and we've looked at the North American data. I guess Tracy Hull was the first author on the five-year data, and the success rate maintained high in the 80s for 50% or greater improvement, and about 40% of patients being fully continent, even when you do the modified worst-case analysis with people lost to follow-up assumed to have failed. You still end up with a success rate in the 60s. So it's, I mean, it's a pretty robust therapy. The Achilles heel, it's a mechanical device, and it could get infected, and you know, reoperation is probably something in the 20% or higher range, and the longer you follow patients, it's going to be 100% because everyone needs their pulse generator replaced at some time, and the leads occasionally fracture. So you know, it's going to be 100%. By definition, you've got to go and replace the stimulator. So the reoperation rate increases. Having said that, if you can get a 5 to 7 year battery life out of it and the patient is significantly better, as has been shown with various indices and scores, you know, incontinence score plus fecal incontinence severity index plus SF36 and bowel health surveys, I mean, there's a variety of instruments we've used. Patients are significantly better. And I think the reason it's appealing is threefold. Number one, unlike artificial bowel sphincter and gracilloplasty and sphincter repair, you're not working near the anus. So the infection risk is a totally different portfolio. It's based on skin infection. You're cutting down to put the pulse generator up on the back, right, near the buttock. The electrode is going in percutaneously. So the infection risk is different. Number two, it's not a binary therapy. You either repair or don't repair a sphincter. You either put it in an artificial bowel sphincter or you don't. You either inject hyaluronate or you don't. This one, you put in the electrode for 2 weeks with the quadrupolar electrode in place. You see how the patient does. And if the patient has 50% or greater improvement, then you can put in the pulse generator. And if they don't have 50% or greater, you can reposition the lead on the contralateral, ipsilateral side, or just remove it. So it's not binary at first, and that's great, unless you try it. So earlier on, we were talking about physiology testing. That beats any physiologic test. How does the patient respond to the therapy? And if it's good, we administer that therapy on a long-term basis. If not, we don't. That trumps any of the other tests because none of them have predictive value. Zero. None. Not sphincter defect or presence or absence of sphincter defect doesn't predict success. Presence or absence of pudendal neuropathy doesn't predict success. Presence or absence of prior sphincter repair doesn't predict success. So what benefit are you going to derive from those studies? You may need them for insurance approval in the U.S., perhaps, or to have a conversation with the patient. But none of them are predictive of outcome. So the third difference is the fact that it changes sensation, because the way SNM works, it stimulates the center in the pontine area, which is also why outside of the U.S. where it's used, percutaneous tibial nerve or transcutaneous tibial nerve stimulation also works, because it stimulates the same center in the pons. Ronan O'Connell in Dublin, amongst others, has done a lot of good work on that. It's not efferent. It's not that it makes the sphincter clamp better. It doesn't. It gives the patient a better early warning system. They know there's something brewing. They've got to go to the toilet. So three big differences. Well, I think it's very appealing. It's also vastly easier technically to do this procedure than a stimulated grossiloplasty, of which I did many, many, many when it was available, or an artificial bowel sphincter. Or it's even easier than a sphincter repair. I mean, there's not a lot to it. So I think it's rather popular, and I believe, based on the numbers I heard, there's something around 2,000 done last year in the U.S., which I think for fecal incontinence, which I think is a jump over what it used to be.
Sir, if you could briefly touch on your experience with bioinjectables. You know, some studies have shown that they improve with up to a 50% reduction in incontinence, but I guess that still means that 50% of them are still incontinent. What is your experience, and what is the role? Who do you use this in?
I really have gone away from the injectables. I think personally, I would rather do radio frequency. And again, in the spirit of disclosure, I've been a consultant for, I think at some point, either current or past, every single company that's had anything to do with fecal incontinence, because perhaps because the incontinence score, they all call me and say, would you look at this? Would you talk to us about this? Whatever. So I don't have any particular horse that's ahead of any other horse in the race. I've worked with all of them. However, since the study that was done by Roman Herman in Krakow, Poland, colorectal surgeon there, and Mariana Barrow from our lab, our head of pathology lab medicine, where Roman rendered pigs incontinent, so he had control group of normal sphincters, he had a group of sphincters that had been rendered incontinent, and pudendal neuropathy in some as well, and then a group who had been rendered incontinent and treated with radiofrequency energy, and sent all this blocks and blocks and blocks blinded to Dr. Barrow, who looked at them, and it turns out that the radio frequency energy actually causes a tissue remodeling where the ratio of collagen and muscle flips. So all of a sudden, instead of a lot of scar, you get muscle regeneration. And the cells of Cajal, which in incontinent patients seem to be in abundance, inhibiting the rectoanal inhibitory reflex, the cells of Cajal are also affected such that the rectoanal inhibitory reflex actually should be getting restored. So I understand to some degree, I think I understand a little bit, how it works. And therefore, if I were to do an augmentation therapy, I would personally pick radiofrequency over an injectable. Injectable is just a bulking agent. What we know about radiofrequency is a bit like SNS, it probably improves sensation. And in fact, that's what all the clinical studies have found. Patients have better sensation. But now, based on the work from Roman Herman, Mariana Barrow, we can understand a bit why they have better sensory capability. I think I'd rather do that to a patient than just bulk the sphincter. In fact, the most recent study out of Italy shows the bulking agent is something like, I think, 82% dissolved by 2 years. It's gone. So there is no further downstream effect.
Dr. Wexner, you briefly mentioned percutaneous tibial nerve stimulation. How do you feel this will fit into the future of fecal incontinence management?
Well, it may not fit in for us for a while because it's not FDA approved and it's not imminently on the horizon for FDA approval for FI. The urologists may be able to do it for overactive bladder, but we can't. And I think before we can, there's probably going to need to be a U.S. trial, so it's going to be a while. But I would urge you to, and again, I don't want to say anything before it's in press, but there's going to be an article very imminently forthcoming in The Lancet from Charles Knowles at Queen Mary, the Royal London, which is a randomized sham controlled tibial nerve study for FI of, I think, 227 patients was the number. So I urge you, when it comes out, everybody look at The Lancet and read about the therapy, because that will be the largest randomized sham-controlled trial of the therapy, and it should be out soon.
That ends our dissection of the day. Now it's time to transition to our tips and tricks. This is where we ask our experts to help us out and give us those tips and tricks to get us out of those sticky situations. And Dr. Wexner, one of the things that comes up oftentimes is, what do you do about following either a anterior section or a proctectomy when you have that left colon that just can't reach? Can you walk everybody through there? What is your steps and what are the different things in order, out of order? What do you like to go back to get that left colon to come down so that you have a tension-free anastomosis with good blood supply?
Well, first thing is I routinely mobilize the splenic flexure in every patient. So I usually use a right side down, head up position laparoscopically, obviously mobilize the splenic flexure. I divide the artery cephalad to take off the left colic, and I divide the vein at the pancreas and duodenum. Next thing I do is I mobilize the mesentery to the middle colic vessels. So I have maximum length. I also divide the omentum beyond the splenic flexure, also divide the omentum over to about the falciform ligament. So that's maximal length I can get. Now, there's a little bit more you can sometimes get. If you transilluminate, you can divide the mesentery, like to, if you make a cut of the mesentery perpendicular to the marginal vessels, it will open in a V shape. So you can get more length there, and you could do that at a few different points where you just don't go right to the vessel because you don't want to tear it, but you can go off and get another few centimeters like that. If none of those things works, it also depends distally how much you have left, because you may be able to get some more length by mobilizing distally and bringing what is left of the rectum cephalad. If none of that works, you can make a window in the terminal ileum under the ileocolic vessels and bring the colon through it, although generally I would only do that if the middle colic vessels are been divided, then everything's running off the right colic. And the other option there is to derotate if you need to. That, again, that's usually only in a situation where the only thing left is the right colon and some of the transverse where you'd come through the mesentery or derotate. Generally speaking, for the left colon, if you get to the middle colic vessels and you also score the mesentery as I've described and you've done high ligations and vessels, I mean, it really should reach if you've done all of those things.
And that ends our tips and tricks segment about getting the left colon to reach.
Okay, so now we're going to round out this interview with our final five. These are five questions we ask all of our authors or interviewers to get to know them a little bit better. The first question is what was the last song played on your iPod, and do you listen to music in the operating room?
Song played on my iPod, I can't off the top of my head tell you. I'd have to look. So I may have to come back to that and have to look at it. But yes, I listen to music in the OR, and the music is whatever the residents and fellows want to listen to. I don't dictate the music. I never have. Whatever they want to listen to is fine by me.
Let's just say that we were in an alternative universe where you did get to dictate what type of music would be played in the Stephen Wexner operating room.
A mix of stuff that I grew up with in the 60s, 70s, and 80s rock, but I also like stuff from the 90s and beyond, and I like some of the current things, too. I mean, it's a rather eclectic mix, and anything from the Beatles and AC/DC and Motley Crue and Elvis Costello and, a couple of the newer, things that are out there, some Katy Perry songs, as odd as that might sound. I mean, whatever is being played. It's fairly eclectic. What is the most recent thing I downloaded? I do remember because it was at a gym, at a hotel gym last week or something. Was called "Shut Up and Dance." I don't even know who or "Shut Up and Dance" with me or something like that. But I couldn't even tell you who the group is. But I heard it. I said, it's not bad. I'll download it. So.
There seems to be a trend among prominent colorectal surgeons in liking Katy Perry. I have to do some more research into this.
Easy there. That's a dig at me if you didn't recognize that.
That's okay. I tell you, my secret that only the people at Roosevelt Hospital know when I was a resident is my moonlighting job when I was a general surgery resident for 4 years was being the house doctor at Radio City Music Hall. So I got to...
That is awesome.
To see, was a phenomenal job. I ran the, there was a whole bunch of paramedics there, and they used to run the office, and my job was more or less schmoozing with people, and when various famous musicians needed things done, making sure it got expedited. It was a lot of fun, so I got to hear a lot of music there.
This final five is about you, not us, but I have to say that my dirty little secret is I love Katy Perry. As a matter of fact, I was on an airplane one time. I was watching the Katy Perry movie once. It finished. I watched it again, and the guy leaned over next to me and said, "Are you going to watch that again?" And I said, "Absolutely."
Well, I didn't even know there was a movie, but I do. But I think,
oh, that's like. It is fantastic. Number two, do you have any hobbies, talents, or interests outside of the OR that you'd be willing to tell us about?
I don't even know that I have talents in the OR, but outside of, other than galvanizing other people to work and help them get excited by things. No, I, you know, basically, what I really like is travel, and I always have. And I travel for work, and I travel for fun, and these days, pretty much any free weekend I have, I go see one of my two sons, one of whom is in Philly and the other was in Boston, and now he's in Manhattan. So a lot of it is traveling, really. I'd say that's my major thing, and trying to stay fit. You know, the older you get, the more you've got to do things to take care of your body. So try to pay proper attention just to working out every day that's possible, which isn't necessarily every day.
So that leads us to our question number three. What is a favorite trip or vacation that you've recently taken?
A lot of different things that I like doing, but I might say possibly going to Australia with my younger son. That was a very cool trip, going to Australia, and when he with my younger son. That may have been the top of the list.
Sir. Question number four, if you had not gone into medicine, what career path would you have chosen?
I probably am genetically programmed for something like politics, I suppose. My grandfather was, when Nelson Rockefeller was governor of New York, he was the undersecretary of labor, and he was attorney before that. My dad was an attorney, became the supervising judge of the Supreme Court for Long Island, now son Suffolk, and those, you know, it was an elected position. And, you know, I might have followed and sued something in the line of politics, I suppose.
And Dr. Wexner, to round up our final five, if you could go back in time and see yourself on the first day of internship, what advice would have you given yourself?
Well, what advice would I give myself? I suppose that, you know, get as much as you can out of every day, because it's the proverbial and probably overused expression of drinking from a fire hose. There's just so much information and so much clinical experience to be had. Try and absorb as much as you possibly can, but you're not going to be able to absorb everything every day, and that's okay. You know, don't beat yourself up about it. You'll have another chance. I think that's probably the best thing, and the advice I give my residents every day, which isn't necessarily their first day, is, you know, when they've done something and they say, why did I do that? And I say, listen, you made a mistake. It's okay. People make mistakes. Learn from it and don't make the same mistake a second time. You know, you're going to make other mistakes, but make different mistakes. Just don't make the same one. Learn from it. And I think that's so perhaps those two things.
Well, Dr. Wexner, we just can't thank you enough for taking the time out. Obviously, we recognize how busy you are, and to have an hour of your time and an opportunity to share your thoughts not only on some of the things about what's going on at the college level and the senior level leadership, but you know, just your approach to something every day that we see in fecal incontinence and getting that left colon to reach down and finally getting to know a little bit more about you in the final five. Thank you so much for joining us on Behind the Knife, and look forward to seeing you again in the near future. And we look forward to having you back as a guest. And we appreciate all your thoughts.
Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you very much, and look forward to participating again in the future.
Just a reminder, we can be found at Twitter at Behind the Knife, on Facebook at Behind the Knife, and on our website at www.behindtheknife.org. We really want this to be an interactive experience, so give us your random fact of the day, your tips and tricks, or topics you want to hear. And we're also going to tweet out who we're interviewing that day, and you guys can send in your questions, and we'll read them live on the show. This podcast can be found on iTunes and any other podcast provider.
All right, looks like count's correct. Sash is closed and the dressings are on.
Until next time, thank you for joining us on Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast. Dominate the day.